Good day, South Dakota, and welcome to Tech Radio featuring the Computer Guys. I'm your host, Kent Osborne. On today's program, we'll discuss the latest in tech news, talk about Google's latest development conference, a user-requested Windows 7 patch, and message bots. Plus, your calls, texts, emails, Facebook posts. We'd love to hear from you. Send your questions via email, midday@sdpb.org, or send a tweet at sdpb. Join the discussion on our Facebook page at facebook.com/techradio or call now, 800-524-3604. You can email your suggestions or questions to our guests today, John T. Meyer, Amos Aesop, and Jeff Litterick. That email address again, midday@sdpb.org. And welcome back to Tech Radio, featuring the Computer Guys on member-supported SDPB Radio. We gathered the experts today to talk tech and answer questions you may have. In the studios of KCSD in Sioux Falls today, we have Lemonly's John T. Meyer with us today. Hey, John.
Howdy, howdy. Thanks for having me.
Let me get your mic turned.
You don't want me.
Well, we do. We do. Exigent Solutions Security Officer Amos Aesop is here.
Howdy.
How is Amos today?
I'm well. How are you?
Absolutely wonderful. Joining us from the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications.
Take two.
From the Bureau in Pierre, Jeff Litterick joins us today. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello.
Great to have you on board today. You can call, text, tweet, or email your questions, or simply swing by our Facebook page at facebook.com/techradio. Post your comment or question there. Don't be shy. Our phone number, 800-524-3604. At SDPB is our Twitter handle, and the email address, again, is midday@sdpb.org. Well, guys, a lot to talk about. I think we should probably go ahead and let's kick this thing off with Google.
Google.
They had their big annual, called I.O., it's their development conference.
Correct.
That happens every year. And interestingly enough, I've seen a lot of blog posts and articles that are pitting their new home product, Google Home, conversational interface, they're calling it, against what we've had on the show before, which is Amazon Echo. So it's kind of an Echo-like device.
Yep.
What have you heard about that?
Well, I think the big thing we're seeing is this, the game is on, right? The game, the competition for the smart home. We've been talking about that for years on this show, how all these products, all of our home products, the Nest thermostat, our refrigerator, either are or will become smart. And so we're seeing the major tech players, Amazon, Google, Apple will be coming, make their play into this space of the tech, kind of the smart home. So Google releases a few products, and interestingly, no ship dates were announced yesterday in their conference. Just a lot of cool things with kind of the later this year, end of summer, this fall type of discussion. So we'll see when these things really hit. But I don't know what you think, Amos, when you saw the Google Home device.
No, I think we've talked about this for a while, and that some of the early devices that come out are really just kind of testing the waters, and everything sort of evolves after that. You get this large group of basically beta testers to run through the easy, quick stuff, right? The simple stuff like what's the weather? Should I wear a raincoat today? That sort of stuff. And then we're going to see it evolve into home automation where already Google is doing things just a little bit better in some respects out of the gate, but they've had the opportunity to learn from Amazon's trials and tribulations. And while they don't have the install base that Amazon does yet, I'm sure they will be working hard to make up that ground.
I think one thing we've seen from people who have the Echo device, I've heard a lot of great things. I think Joel, he's not here with us today, but I believe he has it and really likes it. So do you have one too, Amos?
I do.
Yeah. And you like it?
Yeah, I ordered mine pretty early. It was a pre-order one that I had to wait like a month before I got it. And it's a novelty item. I really haven't kept up with all of the new skills that are available. I did get it to connect to my Nest. but I haven't really gone through the effort. And in some cases, it is quite an effort to get things to work together.
Yeah.
You know, there are some third-party middlewares that allow you to connect two things together, but I haven't really done that yet or done it much. So,
one thing I've read about is this idea. Neither of these products, I don't think on the home yet. I should check on the specs before I say this. Is more of a, are we headed to eventually more of like an always on type of listening device? Because right now you have to have that command, right? So, hey, right. Alexa, play my podcast. Hey, Alexa, turn on the lights. Hey, Alexa, what's in the news today for the Echo? This idea that it's always listening, which is convenient and handy and also a little bit creepy.
Right. And it is, right? I mean, it has to be listening for that command of, hey, Alexa. It just doesn't respond until then. And
but I think the idea is that eventually that won't even happen.
And
you'll just say, turn on the light.
Sure. And what happens when one of those platforms gets compromised?
Sure.
And they can continuously monitor any sound in the house. It's definitely a security concern. I think there's security concerns when it comes to anything on the Internet of Things that we've got, whether it's your Amazon, whether it's the Alexa or the Google Home, or it's your smart refrigerator or your TV or your thermostat. There's a lot of security concerns there that I'm not sure are taken real seriously yet. But once the first time it happens, it people will start to take that
seriously.
I think
one thing that's really fascinating is the way that these companies, well, the way their DNA or what they're best at is reflected in these products. Because now they're all getting into each other's game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're that big of a company, they need to all have a smart product. So
right.
Amazon is great at shipment and content and creating, you know, knowing your preferences because that's what they do great. Google is awesome at data and organizing the world's information. You know, when we see the Apple one, we know it's going to be beautiful and amazingly designed. And so I think
right.
It's interesting the way their DNA plays into their different strengths and weaknesses.
I posted a link out on our Facebook page that talks a little bit about this. And one of the things that they're saying why Google Home is better right now is purely because it's built-in Google search, right? Amazon just doesn't have the search ability that Google does. And so it's inherently better in that respect, but at the same time, you can't tell it to add, toilet paper to your
sure.
to your grocery list and have it show up or to reorder that. So Amazon's got that going for it. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Well, and the big thing is can the future of the message bots and the chat bots get beyond, you know, order me, you know, toilet paper, but create that conversation. As the conversations get more complicated, because mm-hmm. that's where this is all going to go. It's going to go beyond tell me what the weather is.
Sure.
People are just going to ask these things to do more things, more complicated things. And are they going to be able to do that? And I don't know how that, we were going to talk about message bots today. Do you use Assist?
I've kind of played around with Assist a little bit. So for a little bit of context on the transition there, Ken's talking about.
Yeah.
So a big belief is this where things are headed are moving away from apps. Apps are really expensive to create. They're expensive to maintain if you're a brand or a company. You know, new operating system comes up, you need to update your app. And then they're really expensive to actually get to market. The cost per acquisition, you know, you got to convince people to download their app. And they say the average person uses 7 apps a day, and that's it, like the same 7 apps. And so to cut through that top 7, we were talking about people using Facebook, their email, their text, your little app is probably not going to cut it. So the trend in Silicon Valley now, all these big companies are experimenting with text-based messaging, which is funny because tech-wise, it's actually very low-tech. We've had it for a long time. But these automated bots, which some people, that word kind of scares them. So Assist is a company that all you do is add it as a contact into your phone, or you can also use it via Facebook Messenger, and you can say things like, schedule a haircut, order me a taxi, send flowers to my wife. And the whole thing is done just through SMS back and forth with commands. So you say these commands, they come back, say one, you know, if you like this bouquet, send one. If you like this bouquet, send two. If you like this bouquet, choose three. And it's really fascinating because it's actually pretty low tech, easy to build, but they get smarter as well, this kind of machine learning. And so I wanted to hear what Amos or, you know, what Jeff thought about that kind of space these days.
That texting kind of seems clunky to me, but maybe it'd work.
Clunky in what way?
The biggest thing, and you know, some of that stuff is great for automation, right? For example, a company that needs to order the same thing over and over again, it'd be actually easy to set up kind of an automatic type of process so people could click and reorder the same thing over and over. It's great if you know exactly what you want, right? One of the big things I saw in there is you can order flowers, right, through a text. So send a dozen red roses, for example. For the stuff you know exactly what you want, stuff it's really great. It's not that great when you want to maybe browse flowers.com and see what their selection is, but it's great in that kind of stuff, and especially for automation of stuff, especially for companies and B2B and that kind of stuff. I see a lot of that stuff. It has its place, but I think the apps are not going to totally go away either. So,
I agree. I don't think they're going away. I think what we're seeing is a trend here, especially if we're thinking about the people who text all the time. I mean, I'm thinking about millennials and that generation. Often don't, sadly, want to talk to anybody. They don't want to order a pizza, right? Or have to call. So if I can order a pizza by sending a pizza emoji and then it comes back and says pepperoni, you know, just text one for these toppings, text two for these toppings, that's happening. I mean, it's already happening and it's going to be happening more and more.
So this is a layer that sits on top of everything else and makes it better.
Exactly. And what's so funny is that we've had that layer for a long time. It's just becoming, it seems like it's caught up, or now that's the preferred method that the next generation is using.
How is that compared with Facebook M that I got announced several months ago? But is that but that's just really within
So when we talk about major players, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, everyone also now wants to make these assistants, like these, almost think of what's the guy called in like Iron Man, that he'll talk to Jarvis or whatever and he'll do these things. Mm-hmm. Basically these automated bots who you can have as assistants. So Facebook is kind of going a hybrid approach. They're brilliant because they've moved us all to that Messenger app now because it's easier and smoother and a better experience than just doing the message tab in the Facebook app. So now they have us using two of their apps every day. And in that, one of your people that you would talk to, just like I could Facebook message Kent, would be M. And M is a combination of part robot and part actual humans on the back end taking requests. So, hey, what would be the cheapest flight next month? I want to go to Chicago. And the thing would look for flights for me and send back the recommendation.
And that's up and working now?
It's working for some people. I am not a beta user yet, but that feature has been rolled out to some folks.
Okay.
So that's another interesting space, and everyone also is trying to create that. Google will be having one. I mean, Google kind of has your Android guy. What do they call it? I mean, Apple has Siri.
Cortana? No.
Google has just Windows. Okay, Google.
It's just okay, hey,
yeah,
Google.
I don't know if there's a name for it.
Gotcha.
There's nothing to...
Yeah,
it's, well, just... it's... That's true. That's an interesting point, that there isn't a Google name, but there is a... You're asking Google, I guess that's the name.
And there we get back into DNA. Like, I just think Google probably the smartest company, but they're terrible at like branding and marketing their products.
An interesting one also on that is the group that created Siri. That was a third-party company that created it, and Apple bought. They're coming out here soon with a brand new one that's supposed to be even more advanced and platform independent. So
interesting. And I do think Facebook hopefully maybe is on the right approach with this half human. You know, there's actually humans back there too, because frankly, I hate Siri. Like every time I ask Siri, she's like, I don't understand. What do you mean? Can you say that again? I'm like, ugh.
It must be your
never
accent,
mind.
Your accent. You know, one of the things that I'm curious about too, and I don't know if anybody else experiences this, but I mean, we've had voice recognition for a long time, right? I mean, you go back to like Dragon naturally speaking, where you could talk to your computer and it would type it all out for you. I mean, that technology's been around for a long time, but I think one of the things that's kept me from being a super adopter of it is it's just awkward to be talking to an inanimate device, especially when there's other people around. So, you know, if I need to look something up in a group of people, I rarely use my voice recognition on my phone because it just looks odd. There's a just kind of a stigma to it, I guess.
There's a social weirdness there.
Yeah. At what point is that going to be gone away, that we can start feeling comfortable talking to our pieces of metal and plastic.
I mean, one thing I think that I'm convinced of is I still am convinced that wearable tech is going to make it. It just, I think we are still going through that adoption. Like we've, you know, it was years ago when I brought on my Google Glass and we all were just like, this is weird, this is strange. Mm-hmm. But yet when it comes to our phones, all of us have our phone within an arm's reach right now or in our pocket. I mean, it's almost becoming a part of our hands. Like, it's almost there. It's detached. We can leave it, but hardly we never do, or not very far. We always know where it is, and if we leave home without it, we feel naked. That's just the first step, right? And then it's going to become the watch, and then...
That's where I noticed it was the other day. I was in a group of people, and I wanted to search for something. A trivia question came up, and I've got the smartwatch where mm-hmm. I can ask my watch what it is. Instead, I went through the effort of pulling my phone out and typing it in because it just felt awkward doing the Dick Tracy talking to your watch thing with other people around. Now, I've done it by myself. I've done it in a car. But with other people around, I just tend not to do it.
And that's backfired on me, the watch, too. Like, I have the Apple Watch now. I got that for Christmas. And, you know, somewhere along the lines, the last few years, it's become normal, I don't know if I agree, but okay social etiquette for our Kent and I are talking. I pull out my phone. I'm looking something up quick as we're talking, and that doesn't seem to offend you. Whereas, like, I looked at my watch because I got a text, and I thought, this is great. I don't need to pull out my phone. I'm just checking quick. Okay, it's from my wife. Okay, I got it. And I look back at the person, and that was kind of the universal signal for, like, do you have somewhere you need to go?
This is taking too long.
Is this the hint? Right. Like, and I was like, no, I was just reading the text, even though it looked like, okay, dude, finish up.
I'm checking the time, right?
That, like, backfired because we had kind of an older social norm clashing with this new one.
That's interesting, and I was thinking Google Glass at the same time you were there too. That awkwardness that you felt when you were wearing that. So anyway, we do need to take a break. When we come back, we actually have a lot more Google things to talk about, and then the usual security things. We have some Twitter things, and I think there's a Microsoft patch we want to talk about, and some emails and passwords from LinkedIn getting posted somewhere, and just kind of a quick cadre of business to take care of there. But we'll do that after this. And welcome back to Tech Radio featuring the Computer Guys. We've got the experts here at KCSD in Sioux Falls. The students are amid finals now.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if they were done yet, but the parking lot was still pretty full. So
yeah, some folks are moving out. Some folks are still looking pretty nervous. And it's an interesting time of year. But we are here in Sioux Falls at USF. We've got Lemonly's John T. Meyer with us. Exigent Solutions Security Officer Amos Aesop is here. And from the Bureau and Peer, of course, Jeff Litterick. Jeff, what can you tell me about this patch that Microsoft has released? The public clamored for it for Windows 7, and Microsoft gave it up?
Well, Microsoft had stated after Windows 8 and Windows 10 came out a few years ago that there would be no more service packs. Windows 7 is 7 years old now. In that time frame, there was a service pack at year one, and then since then, it's only been security patches. And as you probably, all listeners have heard us talk over the years, there's many security patches every month. So what happens is if you just loaded up Windows, an old version of Windows off a CD, you would need to patch hundreds and hundreds of patches and download actually gigabytes worth of patch data. So instead of doing that and making it very extremely bad, which, as anecdotal, I just had to patch 3 months worth on a laptop that hadn't been patching correctly, and it took over an hour and a half just to get the 54.4 patches downloaded and installed correctly. So instead of taking all that time and wasting all that space, they've basically released a service pack 2 in that what it is just a collection of all the security patches over the years bundled into one. So instead of having to download hundreds of patches, or if you go back a few months, 54 like me, you just download a compressed patch, it installs as one patch, and then you're up to date as of now. And then going forward, any new patches coming out, of course, you would need to apply. But it lets people catch up fairly quickly if you do install a Windows 7 machine at this time instead of going to Windows 10.
Okay. So
it doesn't add any new features or anything like most service pack does. It's just a security patch roll-up.
And this is something that they said they were never going to do, and yet they did it anyway, which is
it's kind of one of those things. I don't believe they envision Windows 7 having all these security patches after 7 years either. So, you know, it's kind of one of those hindsight kind of things.
Yeah. So something that kind of surprised me, I guess, in the security realm, since I've got you on the line, one of the ransomware makers shut down. And they did it wasn't because, I don't think it was because they got caught or, got prosecuted or anything like that. But they actually closed down their shop, apologized for all the damage they caused, and put the master key in an apology on their website.
Well, there's a little bit more to the story. And they walked away with a whole bunch of money. They did give back any of the bitcoins and money that were given them. One interesting thing also, too, was a whole bunch of security researchers about a month before on this one had actually tricked one of their programmers into giving them one of the major keys that unlocked a lot of stuff. And the security researchers actually produced a tool that would auto de-encrypt the files for this particular program. And I think it was at that point that they decided, hey, let's do a PR stunt, publish the master key in case anyone's still infected and walk away. With the key caveat is that they may apologize, but they didn't apologize enough to actually give back the money they got over the years from people who did pay. And a lot of people pay these things. So they actually, the ransomware people actually make a lot of money. There's some staggering estimates out there of just how much they bring in a year because people do pay. One interesting thing we found out about all this behind the scenes and stuff, too, after the security researchers actually tricked them into giving them that key, is that the different groups that produce this actually talk to each other quite a bit. And when someone gets infected and pays up, they actually notify the other people, hey, these guys pay, go infect them, and this is how we did it, so that maybe you can get in and re-encrypt the files and they'll pay you too. So it is kind of a criminal organized to a certain extent, but not like organized as the mafia, but an organized criminal organization doing these ransomwares.
Now, I wonder if that ties into the spate of ransomware attacks on U.S. hospitals and security agencies and things like that. This one, in particular, TeslaCrypt, happened to be it upset a lot of gamers because it would encrypt, it would find and encrypt video games on your hard drive. And if you know anything about gamers, they don't like being away from their games for very long. So I guess that's where those bitcoins come in, Jeff.
Right, and if you think about it, if I go and encrypt a few data files that you have backed up, okay, I restore them, you didn't do much. But if I encrypt all your games and you have, like me, over a terabyte worth of games installed, that's a serious rebuild, right? So you may be a little bit more likely to pay up, too, so because the effort to recover is a little bit more than just restoring a few megabytes of data files. If that. So, they were kind of onto it, and I suspect that crew will be back with something else in the future, or maybe they've made enough money that they really don't care anymore, and they're out of the business, just living off the proceeds they gathered up to this point.
And is the risk of prosecution low? I mean, are they over in an Eastern European bloc, country or something that people aren't going to be able to find them?
Unless they attack their own government and made the local police mad, the chances of them ever being brought to trial or anything is really zero. And if you really do read the estimates of how much money they make, if you are a small crew and you are active for 2 years, you could probably retire for the rest of your life. You are making more than what most CEOs make in terms of real dollars. Of course you have to believe those estimates of exactly how many people are paying and stuff, but I've seen even the low estimates, if you do it for a couple of years, you could probably take 20, 30 years of vacation time when you're done, if you're a small group and you're not sharing the proceeds too much. A risk of prosecution is almost nil. finding out who these people are, zero, and if they're smart, and if they are, even if they're found out, as long as they don't travel abroad too much or to certain countries, they're pretty safe.
Well, that's interesting that you gave us that background, because the stories I read, it made it sound like, hey, these guys are, you know, these guys are okay. They released the master key. They apologized. Everything's going to be good. But that's not really the whole story.
If they had given back all the bitcoins and money to the people that had paid them, I would believe that apology. Until they do, I'm not believing much of it. So.
Yeah, all right. And then we have just a couple more security things to talk about. What was the Twitter firestorm yesterday?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. This actually affects lots of apps, Facebook and many other social media apps. It just kind of blew up on Twitter in that there's a lot of geolocation. Pictures geolocate. Posts can be geolocated. What we mean by geolocate is when you make the post or you take the picture or post the picture on the web, it includes the GPS coordinates of where you're at when that happened or when you took the picture of that exact time, which is handy for a lot of people. But in the Twitter case, it was very easy to scrape thousands of Twitter accounts and find out where you live and work. Basically, just on frequency and a little bit of analysis, for anyone who tweeted even mildly, a person could easily take a anonymous Twitter handle and say, you work at this company at this building, and you live in this house on this block, if you had all the geo stuff turned on, or even more likely didn't know you had it turned on, and you were posting from most likely your phone, even though desktop computers will geolocate some stuff too, because you always get those pop-ups on websites. Do you wish this website to be able to see your location and stuff? So it's one of those security things about, you know, not posting that you're going on vacation and that your house is going to be empty for the next 3 weeks and stuff like that. If you have stalkers, I mean, if you're afraid of stalkers or someone harassing you, you can't be that anonymous anymore, because if you actually had this on, they can pretty much figure out where you live and work. So it's kind of one of those security steps.
And that's true to continue through with pictures even that come from other devices as well. Not just Twitter, but cameras that have a GPS chip in them, typically all the pictures on your phone. There are services and there is software that out there that you can run those photos through to strip that out. More likely what you should probably do is turn that off if you think that's a concern. You know, turn off that geolocation on any of those picture taking devices.
Do you do that?
I don't. But okay. I'm also not much of a social media picture poster either.
Okay. John T. Meyer, probably are.
Well, yeah, I was just going in. I'm trying to remember the setting in. I would recommend if you go to settings in your. This is iPhone. I can't speak to the Android. You should be able to go to. Sorry, this is bad radio. There's a place where you can, each app talks about location, and then in there you can turn them off. And so I have some of them that are set to only when using. So, because a lot of the thing, also that's a battery issue too, is a lot of these apps will be pulling your location in the background. So these apps are just taking battery even when you're not using them. But like, yeah, I do have a lot of apps that I do use the location. For instance, like I was just flying to New York this week, and so then it knows where I'm at, and it can pull my boarding pass, like when I get to the airport. Those things are really handy. But yeah, if I'm posting, and Jeff's exactly right, it still goes back to the fundamentals. Like, don't be tweeting out, I'm not at work, I'm on vacation this week, and sharing your location if you don't want people to know that you're gone. So I would say mine are selective. Some I do let run in the background, and others I don't.
On Android phones, under your little gear wheel thing, there is a location thing, and you can turn that on and off.
Yes.
This is a relatively new phone. I got it yesterday, so
I
don't have a lot of things there.
Uh-huh.
But it does tell you how much the battery usage is, and all those things. And I can turn those off. I'm assuming, since I don't see Twitter in here, and I did when I set my Twitter app up yesterday, it specifically asked me, when you take photos, will you allow us to put your location attached to the photo? And at that point, I just went, well, you know, I'm kind of agreeing to everything today. So just, sure, I just went ahead. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But John, do you let your geo, do you put that EXIF information and all that stuff? Do you let all that go through on your stuff?
So only like on choice, I can, on LinkedIn, or sorry, not LinkedIn, I was looking at your screen, you have LinkedIn. On Instagram, when you post a picture, it'll sometimes ask you, do you want to say where it is? Now, if, when I'm somewhere like interesting or cool, like where the picture is actually taken, you know, at a
Grand Canyon.
Yeah, or, exactly. Okay. I do, and I say, yeah, I'm here. I was there. It's, look at it. But no, when I'm taking a picture of like my daughter, or my wife, just somewhere in Sioux Falls, I don't put that geolocation information on the photo.
It's I like browsing by geolocation because you can do that. I think in Flickr, you know, you want to go look at Grand Canyon photos.
Sure.
You can, it'll pull all the Grand Canyon photos for you if it knows that it was shot there. Just like if I say, I want all the photos shot by a Nikon D800.
Interesting.
And Flickr will pull those because that EXIF information comes through most of the time if it's allowed by the, I guess, by the user, or unwittingly if they didn't know it was doing that and it does it anyway. It'll, you know, or a particular, even a particular lens. If the lens data goes through, you can sort photos by the lens they used.
Okay, I finally found it. So I'll actually give people the interest. And on an iPhone, you do settings, the gear as well.
Yeah.
And then privacy, which is the little hand. And then location services, you can just on or off the whole thing. Or you can go app by app, actually, and say, you know, only while using, never, always. So there are certain apps that you can decide which ones you want to give the location. So
there are a lot of benefits to the location, as everyone's pointing out. Just like use of any kind of technology, there's a lot of benefits. There's some disadvantages, and it's mainly just being aware of the problems that can cause and disadvantages so that the users can make, you know, the correct choice when they are posting a picture of them on a beach in Jamaica or a picture right outside their private residence where they live. You know, there's a difference there. So the main issue I think that happens a lot is users are not aware of it happening until, you know, something bad happens and they get, they find out on the news that this could happen, and everyone overreacts and turns everything off. It's a tool like anything else, and it has some great benefits. Just be aware of the downsides and make the correct decisions.
The one that I always have turned off on my phone is sharing your location, which I get the point that Apple has that is, you know, with your loved ones, or if you, like Joel's daughter has maybe an iPod Touch or even an iPhone, who knows, you could have that turned on so you can pull up, you know, kind of the Find My iPhone, Find My iPad, and I can see where, you know, my daughter is or something. I turn that off because sometimes you'll annoyingly text people and it'll show exactly where you are, and it's like that. No one cares where you are right now when you're texting me.
Yeah, I noticed that there was a, I guess I went through some of the features of the Facebook app.
Sure.
While I was installing it yesterday and doing some, and it was asking me questions about if I wanted to do this and if I wanted to do that. I noticed one of those is, you know, see what which of my friends are near me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that would have to be a whole lot of location sharing going on.
Absolutely, yeah.
To be able to do something like that. So, you know, the fact that they are tracking your every move, apparently, is a...
Well, it's more data, right? It's just one more piece of data that we can give them and they can use to be smarter and, of course, make money. And Jeff's right, though. I mean, you really need the location. Like, I have the weather one always uses my location because then when I travel... I'm not going to punch in that, hey, I'm in Fargo, and I'm going to now track the weather in Fargo all the time. Like, I don't want to know the weather in Fargo, only when I'm there.
That's very convenient.
So my phone will just know.
Have you seen the Google location tracking system? So this is mine, and I pulled it up for 2016, and apparently I don't travel a lot. But it shows that I've taken 15 trips, and it's showing that I was in Rapid City, I was in Minneapolis, I was up in New Effington and around Sioux Falls. And if you narrow that down to, you know,
by month.
Like say today, it actually shows you by time where you've been and that sort of stuff.
And that's so, because you have an Android, right?
It's an Android, and I've been told that it exists for the iOS as well.
Interesting.
Now, I don't know that, but that's location tracking. And if you go to google.com/dashboard, that will show you everything there is to know, or everything that Google knows about you and your phone. It's very interesting.
Well, that happens to be the topic of the next segment of this show, the things that Google is tracking, and we're going to get to that after another quick break. And welcome back to Tech Radio, featuring the Computer Guys. We're in the third half of the show now, winding things down for today.
And, you love that joke.
I do. It's the old car talk thing, right? So this is really interesting, Amos. This dat/dashboard, I just pulled that up. Apparently, I'm not a very well-traveled person. But again, as you mentioned, just got the phone yesterday. So it's right. Just I've only been 9 places, and they're all apparently very boring.
That's a good point, is that you just got the phone yesterday. Location tracking must be enabled by default, right? You didn't turn it on purpose.
Like I said, yesterday was a lot of answering yes and questions.
Okay. When you, because I don't actually know that answer. I don't know if it's on by default or not.
I doubt it.
Oh, I was going to assume yes, but.
Oh, all right. We should go back and begin this segment again by saying that, again, get a hold of us if you'd like. You can tweet us at SDPB. The favorite way is usually people send us an email, midday@sdpb.org. Does all this location tracking scare you, or is this a convenience for you? I mean, let us know what you think. I think there's both sides of the story to be told there.
Yeah, and I totally...
In an emergency, I kind of want it to know where I'm at, you know?
Yeah, I totally see both sides, too. I think it's really more of like a... personal preference. So you talked about, you know, I'm probably a heavy social media user, and my preference is probably a little bit more to share it, and I'm open to that. But I do think I totally understand the other side, which is I don't want to share any of that.
Yeah, in the news this week, there was an article that came out that called Google a serial tracker, and that doesn't mean your Cocoa Puffs in the morning, but it means they said the top 1 million websites. Google is tracking your activities on them on 80% of those. So, you know, 800,000 of the top million websites out there, Google's got its hooks into it. And if you click on anything online, Google knows that. So this is part of the big data thing that you were referring to just a few minutes ago. How well they do at tracking.
Well, I think I was in New York and I flew home on Wednesday, and I pulled up the map from the hotel to the airport to LaGuardia, and I took a cab, and I used the Google Inbox, which is a really slick, it's a Gmail powered app, but it's not the Gmail app. It's actually called Google Inbox, and allows you to kind of archive and snooze emails. It just swipes and it's really slick. But because that email with that American Airlines boarding pass was in my inbox, as I clicked the Maps app that told the, you know, that it was telling me which route the cab was taking, it showed me, it estimated the time that we would arrive, and then also had my flight time to say, hey, you're going to be on time, flight's on time, boarding, that whole jazz.
That is very cool.
And I was like, wow, you know, just there. I didn't do anything. I didn't turn anything on. I didn't have to sync things. And so that's the case for. But then as Amos gets lost in the location dashboard, like, it's also a little creepy. So they track a lot of things.
Yeah, and you know, part of this goes to there was that French order. It was a kind of a global French order, which I don't know what that means, and I don't know if it has any teeth. But you know, they came up with that right to be forgotten. Do you remember that?
I don't remember, maybe
10 months ago, maybe it was longer. I don't know, but they basically said that, hey, you know, people ought to be able to go back and if they want to be private people, they ought to be able to go back and take all that information offline. So if Kent, you know, just wants to be a private person, doesn't want all his data out there that he searched for a Nikon D800 camera on Amazon one time, or, you know, was on eBay looking for, you know, Metallica albums or whatever, not that I would ever do that, I could go back, I could request to Google to just wipe my data.
And that obviously didn't go over, I'm sure.
The question is, even if they tell you they did, do they?
Do they, yeah.
You know? That's the
hard question. We always like to joke when I was working day-to-day at Nine Clouds, and we would give talks or go do, you know, educational workshops. Like, I like to say privacy just doesn't really exist anymore. And I know that saying it that way is a little bit bold and probably a little bit scary, and I don't want to make our...
You know, harsh, too. I mean...
Yeah, but I just think online, I mean... You are what you search, and the things you search are probably going to be on there forever, so be aware of that. And you have to be, I mean, nowadays it's tough, like, you have to be like Jeff, super smart and kind of almost like a hacker to be able to like really clear your tracks. You know, it's more work to clear your tracks.
Yeah, it used to be that
the other way around.
Data resided on your computer and it was cookies. You went in and you cleared those and then everybody forgot about what you'd previously done. But now that information's being stored server side, you've got very little, if any, ability. Although Google does give you the opportunity to go in and in theory, delete all the information about it.
On the server?
I'm curious on their servers.
And how do you do that?
As to what it is. It's on that same dashboard location. You can go in and say, delete all my history. You can also download all that history.
And can you select? Can you parse it out? Or is it all or nothing?
I think it's an all or nothing. Sure. I haven't seen it for a while, but I know the option was there.
You can delete individual things. I was just in there because they improved it since I was last in there. I actually use it doing to make sure no one's trying to hack my account because it gives all access to all Google resources on my account. I can go through the list and see who's tried to ever, before they log in, access my services. But most of the stuff, some of it, like email, it's all or nothing. It's all your email or nothing. But location and email is separate and can kind of be deleted separately. And different services, but you'd be surprised if you ever go search how much and how varied the data they are keeping on you is.
And you can download that and take a look, right? And see what they're tracking on.
Well, you can do it online or you can download the data as well.
Some of the data is not downloadable. I don't think location data is, but like your email and stuff and calendar are downloadable.
We'll have to, you know, I'll put a Facebook post out about that because this seems like / dashboard. It seems like a really useful tool for a lot of different things, not just to play around with the location data, which is fun, but there's a myriad of other security and other things you can get to in that dashboard. I think there's your authentication stuff. And Jeff, do you have 2-factor authentication on all your Google stuff? Is it that important to you?
Yes.
I do recommend that as well.
And for example, if you have an Android device, like Ket does now, it lists each Android device, and it shows you the last time they backed up and for each app and stuff. You can actually load apps and take apps off remotely through the dashboard off the phone. So you don't even need to be on the phone to actually install an app. You could do it through the Play Store, too, but you can, through the dashboard, remove and install, see when they last backed up their data. If you have books, it shows you books, Blogger. I mean, everything with Google does, you can see the stuff and how much disk space you're using, how many voice calls I made, for example, YouTube videos, playlists I have. And you can manage all your settings through that. The Google dashboard is a way to manage everything Google does, privacy settings, account settings, authorization settings, history settings, everything's through that one kind of pane, which is really quite handy once you realize and start using it.
And for clarity there, when we talked about 2-factor authentication for the listeners, so essentially what that is 2 levels of privacy to log into your apps or to the different products. So it could be your password, and then often, you know, I have an app on my phone that's called Google Authenticator. Mm-hmm. I open that app, and it has maybe like a 20-second timer, and on that 20-second timer, they give me like a 6-digit number. Mm-hmm. And so your app, you log in with your password that may already be saved, who knows, and then it says, you know, enter this 6-digit code, and that the way that is secure is that every 20 seconds that code resets and refreshes. So the nice thing it is getting a little easier to be to be secure as we start to think about like biometric, and I love the fingerprint deal on my iPhone. I'm assuming Android has something like that as well.
Yes.
And that's becoming really slick. So I do think some of that stuff, as that gets implemented, will be easier to stay secure.
Yeah. So the app on the phone just makes it so that you kind of know that this is the person logging in. It's you with your phone.
Yeah. So it's not just I have the password, but also I also have the phone with me and I have the 6-digit code that I have to manually enter.
And that could be either that or perhaps
Verizon today. What other 2-factor authentication?
They'll text you. They can text you a code that you put in.
Sure.
So again, you need to be with your phone. But that's incredibly convenient. I just had that happen about an hour ago. So there are other ways of doing 2-factor authentication, but that's what that means. 1 extra layer of security to log into something so that if a hacker gets your password, they know your password, but they're actually not going to get in. And chances are if they try, then you're going to get a notification back saying, hey, somebody's trying to get into your account.
And, yeah,
that's
Google is good about that. They'll say, hey, someone from this location.
That sounds really cool, but it's really scary when it happens and when it's not you. Anyway, we want to mention a couple quick things just so before time gets away from us. In June, Tech Radio is on the 3rd and the 17th. Those are our days. So if you'd like to join us on those, you may. But, of course, we're always online on Facebook, facebook.com/techradio.
Lots of posts today.
Excellent, excellent. I haven't browsed through there, but is there
Amos posting lots of links to what we do stuff that.
Oh, do you have dashboard on there?
If you want
beautiful.
To get more.
So if you want to know more about dashboard or how to get to it, Amos has put that on our Facebook page. Of course, Twitter's always open at SDPB. That's how you get a hold of South Dakota Public Broadcasting if you'd like to. Lots of things going on this weekend. State tennis is going on out in Rapid City.
Yeah.
So we're posting lots of tennis pictures and results on that. And, of course, the juggernaut state track coming up Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, I love that.
At O'Gorman, Howard Wood Field, in Madison. The A's are in Madison this year.
They
on
still
Friday.
Used to do Brandon. I remember when I were in track, I'd have to go Brandon the first day.
And not then... this year.
Okay.
Not this year. Yeah.
O'Gorman, and huh?
Usually it's Lenox for the A's, but it's Madison this year.
Okay.
O'Gorman, yeah. And then at Howard Wood on Friday. And then, of course, everything converges for the massive event on Saturday. That is a spectacle upon itself. We'll, of course, live stream the running event Saturday morning. Those will be the finals of all the things. So join us online if you can't join us in the stands. But it'll usually a great way to spend your Memorial Day weekend at State Track.
Nice. And both the school we're at here at USF, and I know my cousins are graduating from Augie this weekend. So
yeah, best of luck to all the graduates this weekend. I know some folks at Briar Cliff and other places are getting that degree this weekend. And what an exciting time to be alive. Going out and, of course, posting resumes online and doing all the things and all those advantages the kids have nowadays that we didn't have back in the day. But good luck to them as well,
because
that's a great point. That's about all the topics we had for
today. Let's do that one quick on your screen, the Netflix one, because that's easy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What was the deal with Netflix launching Fast.com?
Well, Fast.com is something that Netflix provided so that people can get a realistic understanding of what their internet speeds are. There's always been some confusion on the available speed tests that are out there or the realistic whether they were accurate or not. And so Netflix is suggesting that if customers take this or go to Fast.com and find out that they're not getting what they've been paying for, that they should talk to their ISP about it. And it's, it's in Netflix interest for you to be getting the most bandwidth you can, because you're more likely to utilize their service as much as possible. And
Good internet here. Kent just showed us.
Yeah. 91 megabits per second.
And you're using the guest Wi-Fi here?
Yeah. Not the Wi-Fi. I'm plugged in, actually.
Oh, plugged in. Sure.
But yeah, so a little schism between, Netflix is basically saying, hey, don't believe what you got on speedtest.net.
Right.
Check this one, because this is the one we use.
Mm-hmm.
So if that was, I assume, buffering issues or other customer service problems they've been having.
Yeah.
So fast.com.
And it's quick and easy. It starts the test automatically. It takes about 5 or 6 seconds for it to complete, and it gives you a good idea on how fast your actual connection is.
You a Netflix user?
I am.
There's codes you can put in to get hidden categories in Netflix. Is this a Snopes thing, or is that an actual thing?
Do some Googling on that. There are apparently some inside categories that are sometimes humorous and sometimes useful. But Google hidden Netflix categories.
Sometimes humorous and sometimes useful. That's kind of, I won't say that's a synopsis of our show. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank our panelists today. I want to remind you that SDPB is always there for you with our app, or at sdpb.org. Go there and click on listen. Have a great weekend, everybody.